More than 3 years after the start of the latest round of violence in the Middle East, there are signs that some Israelis are becoming disillusioned with the tactics of the government of Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Some of the sharpest criticism comes from the ranks of the military, from reservists who refuse to serve in the West Bank to the current chief of staff. Public opinion polls show a drop in support for the prime minister, and there is a new challenge to his policies on peace. Israeli leftists and Palestinian notables negotiated an unofficial peace agreement. Copies of this virtual accord are being delivered to every household in Israel. Later in this program, we'll speak to a former aide to John F. Kennedy about what happened at the White House on the day the president was shot in Dallas, and why the National Hockey League is taking its game outdoors for the first time. But first, the growing dissent in Israel. If you've been to Israel lately, if you have friends or relatives there, call us and let us know what you're hearing or seeing. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. In a few minutes, we'll be hearing from former Minister of Defense Moshe Arens and from Knesset member Amram Mitzah, the former Labor Party chairman. But first, NPR's Linda Gradstein joins us to help us understand the context of these developments. And Linda, thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Neil.
Have you, by the way, received a copy of this peace agreement on your front door?
I did. It was in my mailbox, I think, 3 days ago. It's a pamphlet. It's a fairly thick pamphlet, about 30 pages long. And the sponsors of the Geneva Accord have just started radio ads in Hebrew on Israel radio. There was actually a court challenge. They tried to put ads on, and the court originally said it was political propaganda. They were allowed to put the ads, but they had to change them, taking out a line saying, read it and see for yourself, and just announcing that the accord had arrived in people's mailboxes. On the Palestinian side, it's being published in newspapers because the mail distribution in the West Bank and Gaza is not as, it doesn't go to every single house the way it does in Israel.
Mm-hmm. How is this document being interpreted by people?
Well, one of the things that's interesting, I heard a poll this morning on the radio that most people haven't even read it, and yet about 40% of the public supports it without having read it, even after it was delivered to people's households. The committee spent over $600,000 to have it delivered to people's homes, and Israelis don't seem to be reading it. On the other hand, the fact that an unofficial peace plan could get that kind of support, I think, shows just how much Israelis are sort of looking for a way out.
We're going to hear more about this from one of the men who helped craft it. But essentially, as I understand it, this was the product of a 2-year negotiation sponsored by the Swiss Foreign Ministry. And who exactly was involved?
Well, who is involved are on the Israeli side is the former Minister of Justice, Yossi Beilin, who has been involved in the peace process since the beginning of the Israeli-Palestinian peace agreements more than 10 years ago. He was one of the drafters of the Oslo peace agreement that was negotiated secretly and first signed in 1993. On the Palestinian side, it's the former information minister, Yasser Abed-Rabo, as well as Palestinian security people. So there's nobody who's in government right now, although there are several members on the Palestinian side who are members of the Palestinian parliament. On the Israeli side, there are Knesset members like Amram Mitzna, who I believe you're speaking to.
Yes. Now, this proposal comes complete with maps. It states what will be done with the Palestinians' demand for a right of return. Jerusalem, all these issues are laid out. Is there anything startling in this?
Well, there really are two startling things. One is that the Palestinians are given sovereignty over the Muslim holy places on a site that is holy to both Jews and Muslims, that Jews call the Temple Mount and Muslims call the Haram al-Sharif, with all kinds of arrangements made for free access of Jews as well. But it's given to Muslim sovereignty, which is something that is very controversial in Israel. On the Palestinian side, Palestinians more or less, depending on how it's interpreted, give up the right of of return of Palestinian refugees to the state of Israel. The accord says that Israel will accept the same number of Palestinian refugees that other countries accept. There's been a big debate over in Israel whether it actually is giving up the Palestinian right of return. But all the reports that I've read and the people that I've spoken to say that that's exactly what the trade that was given, that Israel gave up sovereignty over what Jews call the Temple Mount and Palestinians call the Haram al-Sharif, and the Palestinians gave up the right of return to the state of Israel and will return only to a state of Palestine, which will be more or less in the 1967 borders.
Now, some of the broader context as well, this comes amid some unprecedented criticism of government policy from present and former military and security heads, and I guess that would include four former heads of the Shin Bet, very roughly the Israeli equivalent of the FBI. What were they talking about?
Well, that interview came out last Friday in the weekend newspaper, in Israel's top circulation daily. It was unprecedented in the public criticism by four top security officials that the policies of Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon had over the past 3 years had gravely damaged Israel and its people. The four security chiefs said there is no military solution to the conflict and said that Israel is on the road to catastrophe. It has sparked quite a debate in Israel over the past week. It comes after last month the chief of staff told columnists from three leading newspapers that Israel's closures and curfews and roadblocks were increasing hatred and terrorism and causing a possible explosion. Now, Israeli politics has always been fairly vocal. Anyone who's ever been here, there are often political arguments on street corners, and Israel has a very critical press. But the fact that this is
often described as a contact sport in Israel.
Yes, yeah. It, politics here is a contact sport. But the fact that this is coming from within the military security establishment is what's unprecedented.
And this is the current chief of staff. He works for Ariel Sharon.
Yes, he works for Ariel Sharon, and in fact, there was some talk about whether he could continue to be the chief of staff after this criticism. And Prime Minister Sharon insisted he not be fired. I think it reflects a debate going on, both among the Israeli public, but also inside the Israeli army, with some military officials saying that Israel has to ease restrictions on the Palestinians, and other military and security officials saying that Israel has to crack down harder.
Some of the things I've read in terms of the criticisms from the military officials are that this government seems to have only tactics rather than a strategy.
Well, that's certainly something that people are saying. They say that that neither side can win militarily. I was just in the West Bank today, and I was speaking to Palestinian cabinet ministers, and they said to me, "Look, we always knew we couldn't win militarily, but Israel thought it could, and now Israel is coming to realize that it can't win militarily either." So the question is, if you've come to the conclusion that you can't win militarily, then what do you do about it? And there is growing criticism of the government of Ariel Sharon that there really is not an overall strategy for coming to some kind of a peace deal, that there's just trying to crush the uprising, the Palestinian Intifada, by force. And it's been more than 3 years now, and that hasn't worked. A lot of criticism is also coming from parents of Israeli soldiers who are guarding Jewish settlers, sometimes guarding small outposts of Jewish settlers. And some of these parents are saying, this is not what I want my children involved in.
Now, some members of the armed forces have also signed statements refusing to serve in Palestinian territories.
Yes, close to 600 of them, both active duty and reserve personnel, have said that they will not serve in the territories, and probably hundreds of others have quietly asked to be transferred. The most public of this was a letter signed by 27 former and reserve pilots in September, saying that they would no longer fly missions attacking Palestinian militants in assassination attempts, in airstrikes, in which which Palestinian civilians are also often killed. Mm-hmm. Israel says, Israeli officials say it's collateral damage. They say they're not aiming for these people. But these pilots said that they would not fly these missions anymore. And the pilots are really the elite in the Israeli armed forces. And it caused a huge stir here and a huge controversy over whether it was appropriate or not for them to say that. Until all of this started, it's always been that dissent is acceptable, but not from within the army, and that the army has to stay focused on its task. And again, the fact that this is coming from within the army and within the armed forces is really a revolution here.
Still, this is just, well, if you add them all up, fewer than 700 people, at least publicly so far. The IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, is it's close to 200,000.
Right.
How widespread is this?
Well, and that's a question. I mean, there's a debate over how significant this is, and that partly seems to depend on where what your politics are here. Those who tend to be on the more dovish side of the Israeli spectrum see it as the beginning of a massive public move against this, and what they say is that this is how the Israeli opposition to the war in Lebanon began, which eventually culminated in a demonstration of close to 500,000 people, and eventually most analysts agree that public pressure played a very large role in Israel's withdrawal from Lebanon 3 years ago. Those on the more right or hard line of the Israeli political spectrum say this is a tiny phenomenon and doesn't have any significance, and the fact is that 200,000 military personnel are continuing to carry out their missions as they're supposed to, and that this small group is getting a lot more public attention than it deserves.
Again, we're going to be hearing from senior officials from both right and left in a few minutes. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Leslie, who's in Leawood, Kansas.
Hello.
Hi.
There were about 115 people from Kansas City, some of whom are just coming home today from Israel. I came home on Sunday. And to some extent, I'm still coming to grips with all we saw while we were there. We traveled all over the country.
Were you there as a tourist?
We were there. Actually, I'm part of a young leadership development group here, but we were part of the missions going on the Jewish Federation General Assembly time there. There were about 4,000 Americans, North Americans, I should say, because there are also Canadians there.
Mm-hmm. And what did you see? What perception do you come back with?
Well, confused perceptions, because we met with all different kinds of people, from Ahmadi Muslims who profess a sort of Gandhi-esque peaceful mission of Islam, to Druze who live across many borders in the region.
Mm-hmm.
And who are relatively they themselves are not nationalistic, so they basically end up supporting the countries in which they live. So sometimes you get an awkward situation of Druze fighting family members when, say, Syria and Israel find themselves on opposite sides, as they often do.
And we're running a little short of time, Leslie.
Okay. Well, I think the main thing is I want to reiterate some of what your guest was talking about, because I think what we heard was a real concern looking at Sharon's long history of settlement development as really structural defensive systems, that he himself can't or won't or is unable to find a way to an alternate view of an Israeli state. That he, in some ways, there has to be an answer to him, and the people that we talk to on the left are very frustrated at not being able to find a voice to counter this. But they are active. They do put up political posters. They do try and advertise, their activities. And I think that's maybe a little stronger than it has been in the last 3 years. But they fight within among themselves, because even those who tend to be more dovish really come down to this whole idea of security.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, Leslie. Thanks very much. And Linda Gradstein, thank you very much for your time. We'll be back after a short break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're talking about recent developments in Israel that some say are signs of growing frustration by many Israelis with lack of progress towards peace and worry about unending cycles of violence. You're invited to join our discussion. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from his home in Haifa is Amram Mitzna, the former chairman of the Labor Party in Israel. He helped craft the agreement called the Geneva Initiative that maps out a peace plan for Israelis and Palestinians. He's currently a member also of the Israeli Knesset, and it's good of you to be with us on Talk of the Nation.
Well, good evening.
Could you describe for us briefly how this agreement came about?
Well, you know, in the political vacuum that we have now in Israel because of the government strategy, we decided, two groups, Israeli participants and Palestinian participants, to get together and to try to continue what was stopped 3 years ago in Camp David after Carter initiative, and to try to reach some kind of agreement between the parties. The idea was, and it is, of course, the idea today, is to let people in Israel and in the Palestinian Authority to get the feeling that there is a lot to talk about, and in both sides there are people that are really open to negotiations. The initiative, the Geneva Initiative, is unique because of the participants on both sides. People that are coming from all levels of society on both sides, some people that served many, many years in the security forces, some people that are politicians, and some people from the academy. Secondly, the idea and I think it was the first attempt ever to come to a detailed agreement, not to leave anything open, even the most sensitive and painful issues like refugees, borders, Jerusalem, and many other issues. So this was the idea, and we successfully reached and what we say a model of agreement that should be the agreement future with between Israel and the Palestinians.
Were you at all concerned by the prospect that you may have been undermining the current government, that you were in effect sort of conducting your own foreign policy?
Well, you know, I think it is duty of people like myself that do think that the government of Israel has no solution to the situation. And therefore, we wanted to demonstrate that it is possible. We said loud and clear that we do not represent the governments. We even don't represent the people. We do represent a group of people that are being supported by a lot of other citizens, both sides, that there is another way, there is another alternative. People here in the Middle East were brainwashed for years that there is nothing that can be done, just to crash the rising intifada and to try to win it militarily. And we want that people will understand that there is an alternative. Now, we hope that government will take advantage of the model that we brought and is the way to reach an agreement.
We're going to get a listener on the line now, and joining us from Sacramento in California is Ahmed. And Ahmed, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hello, Mr. Mitzna. My question to you is, what is the mechanism by which the Geneva Accord could come into play? Here in the States, we have things like referendums. Is there any possibility that this accord could be put to a vote?
Well, no. There is no way to do it like this. But the first stage is to launch a campaign in order that people will understand that there is another alternative. Now, hopefully, that the Israeli government, and I'm speaking on the Israeli government, will ease its restrictions on the Palestinian people and may be more moderate with the negotiation with the Palestinians. But the second phase is the political, of course, platform. Hopefully, that next elections, people will see that there is an alternative agenda, and then they will vote.
Some people would say, sir, that in effect they saw something very much like this plan in the last election and voted overwhelmingly against it.
Well, yes, I really agree with you. You know that there is a very interesting paradox here in Israel. Most people in many polls say that they are ready to make very deep and sensitive concessions. But on the other hand, they don't vote to people that are bringing such an idea. And you can ask yourself, what happened? What is the reason? And I think that one of the reasons is that people here are in state of mind of fear, and they don't believe that there is a way to reach an agreement. And we were not ready enough a year ago. Hopefully that I'm speaking about the realistic part of the Israeli society, the people that believe in reaching an agreement with the Palestinians, will succeed better next time. Now, I want you to understand, my strategy, my belief is that we have, the Israeli people have to separate ourselves from the Palestinians. This is the strategic goal. Either it will be by agreement, and reaching an agreement is the best way to secure the state of Israel and to let it develop. But if agreement is impossible, then we will have to unilaterally withdraw this most of the settlements from the West Bank and Gaza Strip and put a border between the Israelis and the Palestinians and wait to the future. But the idea is the understanding that there is no way, and we have to understand it, to control, to occupy 3.5 million Palestinians against their will. We must stop this situation.
Let's get another caller in. This is Edward, who's with us from Nashville, Tennessee.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
I appreciate Mitzna's efforts. However, you have to question a bit whether or not he's actually making it more difficult for the Israeli government to reach a peaceful settlement. When people go in and start putting down extra governmental proposals, it gives a space of questioning and hope to Palestinians and Palestinian terrorists in particular who do not want to see the government succeed. When people like Mitzna come in and make these proposals, what they allow for is the continuation of the status quo because there shows to be a fracture and a weakness in the Israeli government position.
Amram Mitzna?
Well, unfortunately, the government of Israel has the chance for the last 3 years to open new channels, new alternatives, but they didn't succeed. You know, I'm not trying to say who is to be blamed about the situation. For me, as an Israeli, I am asking my government responsibility to change the situation. And therefore, I think in our democracy, when you have a coalition and you have an opposition, we have. It is not just our right, but it is our duty, our responsibility as parliament members and as people here in this region to try to bring new ideas. Now, it is essential because, you see, the situation now in Israel is worse than ever. Time is not playing on our side. And, you know, you talked just a few minutes ago about a lot of signs in the Israeli society that many people do understand that there is no way just dealing the situation using power. We are the strongest military organization in the Middle East. I served in the army for 30 years, but I know what are the limitations of using power, of using forces. And therefore, it is a duty, it is a must to bring an idea, to show people that it is possible, and to get rid of despair and loss of hope.
Edward, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Amram Mitzna, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Amram Mitzna, presently a Knesset member for the Labour Party, a formerly chairman of the Labour Party, and he spoke with us from his home in Haifa, Israel. Joining us now is the former Minister of Defense for Israel, Moshe Arens. He's with us from his home in Savion, Israel, and it's good of you to be with us tonight.
Nice to be with you.
And I want to ask you about some of the reports of dissatisfaction within the military, but we were just talking, as you heard, with Amram Mitzna about this Geneva initiative. What do you think of it?
Well, I think it's the sort of thing you probably would not expect to see in any democratic country, that people will go out and negotiate a political settlement when whatever they have to say, they should say to their own public, and in Parliament, and if they expect to get a majority at the next time elections come around. But it is not done anywhere, and I think also not in the United States, that you go out and to a parallel negotiation in addition or instead of the government. So I don't think this is looked on very kindly by most of the Israeli public.
Let's get on to some of those other things that we were talking about earlier. I don't know. I assume, well, obviously, I don't think our signal reaches quite that far. But we talked about the members, the reservists who had asked not to serve in the West Bank, the fighter pilots, and the criticism by former heads of Shin Bet and the Army Chief of Staff. What do you make of this?
I think that this is really no more than marginal. You know that in Israel we have a system of reserves. People get called up to do reserve duty until the age of 45 or so. They do up to 30 days a year in reserve, so whenever you go to a meeting or to a workplace, you'll find that almost 10% of the people are not at work. They're in the Army. And we find that people report for their reserve service. It's almost 100%. So what you hear is no more than a marginal phenomenon.
Yet we've not heard things like this before.
No, we've heard things like that before. Look, this is an open society, and it's a society in which everything is debated, and everybody has an opinion. And yes, we've had occasions in the past where some people have come up and said they don't want to serve in the West Bank. This is not the first time this has happened, but it does not have a serious impact. Either on the Army or on the Israeli public.
It's certainly unusual for the currently serving chief of staff of the IDF to come out and criticize the government, though.
Well, first of all, that's an entirely different matter. The chief of staff did not say that he will not serve in the West Bank.
He did not.
And the chief of staff did not say that he will refuse to take orders from the government. The chief of staff expressed an opinion. Again, in democratic countries, generally, the military, including the top military men take their orders from the government, and whatever they have to say, they have the opportunity to say to the government, but generally not to the public. Now, I know that you've had this sort of instance in the United States as well. I think during the Gulf War, in the previous Gulf War, I think an Air Force general was fired for speaking out to the public. It's happened in Israel before. It's not a crisis of any sort. There was some talk that maybe the chief of staff ought to resign, but it's been passed over. He's a good chief of staff. He's highly appreciated by the government and by most of the public.
We're speaking with Moshe Arens. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a listener on the line. This is Esther, who's on calling us from Cleveland, Ohio.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was in the West Bank for 2 weeks at the beginning of September this year, and the comment I'd like to make is I agree with the former heads of Shin Bet that the military tactics are in themselves a huge obstacle to peace. What most Americans might not understand is just the scale of the occupation and how bad it is. The lack of freedom of movement, the economic devastation, and almost the constant daily violence really make it hard for a lot of Palestinians to try to establish a dialogue with Israelis on an individual basis. So if that's difficult, I would think that on a political basis, it's even more difficult.
Well, if you're, Esther, if you're in the area, then you must realize that Israel for the past 3 years has been fighting a very difficult battle against terrorism. We've lost over 1,000 people during those 3 years. mostly civilians, many of them children.
Yes.
And fighting terrorism is no easy matter. As the United States knows, these past few years, since September 11th, as the poor Turks are finding out as a result of the terrorism that occurred there today. And it's very hard to fight terrorism that comes in an area in which civilian populations are living without making life more difficult for the civilians. It's just another way of doing it.
How would you respond to the question that your occupation tactics make you more prone to terrorism, that is, less safe? I've heard that a lot from both sides.
Yeah, but I don't think there's any basis to that, because we know who the terrorists are. They're the religious fundamentalists, the Hamas, the Islamic Jihad. They cannot be placated. You cannot negotiate with them. They're out to kill as many Jews as they can. And that's their purpose.
Thank you.
And there's no other way of fighting them than making life difficult for them.
Esther, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome.
Okay. Let's go to Danny. And Danny's with us from Las Vegas, Nevada.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an Israeli living in Las Vegas right now. I was in Israel a couple of weeks ago, and I consider myself a moderate Israeli. I'm in the center, and there's a lot of confusion among us Israelis, or among us centrists. It's a very controlled confusion. I agree with both sides. I think the exercise that was done now with the Geneva Accord is a beautiful exercise, but it's only an exercise. But it won't take place until we can trust the Palestinian side. And right now we do not trust them. So this exercise is giving a message to the Palestinians. Yes, we can work out things, but we need you to do some things. We need to trust you more, and especially in the aspect of combating terrorism. And just to give an idea, you mentioned before that some 40% of the Israelis are supporting this agreement.
According to a poll, yeah.
3 years ago, when Barak came back from Washington and then from Taba, more than 50% of the Israelis supported this. So there's been a decline. And Israelis have to build up confidence. And I truly believe, I'm a little pessimistic that it's not going to happen, although I would like it to happen. I would like to give back territories if it was up to me. But I can't do it just now. I mean, not that I'm doing it myself, but as my opinion. And therefore, the building of defense is right now the best solution that I can think of.
Danny, thanks very much. Moshe Arends, we just have a few seconds left if you wanted to give a reply.
Well, I don't know how an Israeli in Las Vegas feels about this, but my guess is that most Americans would not have felt very good if during the crisis with Saddam Hussein, some Americans had gone over to Baghdad and started negotiating an agreement with Saddam Hussein instead of the President of the United States.
Moshe Arends, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Moshe Arends, a former Minister of Defense for Israel. He was with us on the phone from his home in Savion, Israel.